I'm David Delegator. Okay, class, here's the quiz. When was the last time a poet, or writer of fiction for that matter, created a work that profoundly and irrevocably altered patterns of cultural behavior in the United States? Here's a clue. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz, who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated, who passed through universities with radiant, cool eyes hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedy among the scholars of war. Got it yet? Great. In 1957, police arrested Lawrence Ferlinghetti, owner of the City Lights bookstore in San Francisco, for publishing Allen Ginsberg's Howl and other poems. The ensuing obscenity trial thrust Ginsberg and his subterranean beatnik friends into the national spotlight. Shortly thereafter, the first beat novel, Jack Kerouac's On the Road, was published, and as a culture, we would never be the same again. Bill Morgan, who has written at least a dozen books on the beat writers, has a new book out entitled The Typewriter is Holy, The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation. He was Allen Ginsberg's personal archivist, and for close to 40 years has worked as an editor and archival consultant to the poets Gary Snyder, Gregory Corso, Michael McClure, and Diane DePrima, as well as the novelists William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac. In this new work, Morgan narrates the history of the beat movement, tracing the origins from the days of World War II to the notoriety of the 50s and the social upheaval of the 60s, a decade utterly incomprehensible without grasping the social ripples set in motion by the beats. So, what did the beats believe in? Morgan makes a cogent case that the beats, contrary to most academic definitions, were not a literary movement, but a group of friends who, through their writings and nonconformist lives, collectively challenged the staid and complacent America of the post-war years. At a time when our polemics were dictated by Ozzie and Harriet and Lucille Ball, the beats dabbled in free love. They stood for free expression and opposed all censorship. They studied and practiced Eastern philosophies, and through their writings opened America's eyes to alternative forms of spirituality. Many were social activists, advocating on behalf of the downtrodden and oppressed, and early dissenters of the influence that military and corporate culture had begun to play in American life. And they were firm believers in the liberating influence of hallucinogenic drugs. In other words, they were totally American in their love of individual freedom. Perhaps it should be no surprise that J. Edgar Hoover described them in 1960 as one of the three greatest threats to American security after communism and intellectual eggheads. Here's my read. The beats were about manifest destiny of the mind. That 19th century political concept held that it was the destiny of America to expand across the continent. Well, long before World War II was over, that destiny had been met. Las Vegas had been installed, and you could drive to Alaska by automobile. The last space left for Americans to grow was the one between our ears. What we've always had was our imagination. That's what the beats figured out and acted upon. Today, is there anything more iconically American than the road trip? When Kerouac and Neal Cassady went on the road, they were just two guys with no obligations aiming their car somewhere else. The beat movement was profound enough in its impact that television both lionized and satirized it. In an obvious rip-off of the Kerouac novel, CBS created the TV series Route 66 in 1960 with Martin Milner and George Maharis as two restless men unable to embrace bourgeois conformity, crisscrossing the country, looking for some meaning to their lives in 116 hour-long episodes over 5 years. And once experienced, who could forget the quintessential beatnik caricature That proto-hippie Maynard G. Krebs is played by Bob Denver in The Many Lives of Dobie Gillis. The difference between the Beats and many of us is that they were no Walter Mitties. Their lives, as documented by Morgan, were peripatetic to the extreme. Many, including Ginsberg, were merchant marines catching a ship to anywhere whenever the notion struck. How many of us right now would like to stand up, pack a duffel, and disappear? The Beats continued to fight for freedom on many levels. When Ginsberg's Howl was found to have redeeming social value by the courts, the groundwork was laid for the publication of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer. Even though the stench of McCarthyism had not dissipated, censorship would no longer be tolerated as an American tool to suppress the discourse of ideas. And many of the Beats gladly volunteered to participate in the Stanford LSD experiments, ironically sponsored by the Department of Defense. Clearly, the Beats were no angels. Essentially a practitioner of Dadaism, William Burroughs was an utter misogynist who, in a William Tell reenactment, killed his first wife while drunk, attempting to shoot a shot glass off the top of her head. In another bizarre misadventure, he spent a year of his life wandering the Amazonian jungles while searching for the psychotropic plant ayahuasca after deciding that acid was so 5 minutes ago. Kerouac spent most of his life literally running from both his daughter and her court-ordered child support payments. A gentle pacifist, he was a political conservative, yet a punching bag for right-wing critics, a chronic alcoholic, and an original idiosyncratic genius of a writer, dead at 47 from cirrhosis of the liver. Most of the Beats had similar dysfunctional tales to tell. But The Typewriter is Holy is more about relationships and less about social and literary influences of the Beat movement. There are other books for that. This is about linkages between exceptional writers, their lives together, and their almost incidental reminder to each of us that we hold the universe in the eye of our mind. In what was a dark age of civil liberties, we owe a debt to the Beats for upsetting the conformist status quo and for making us look back to the Constitution and seeing that equality, spiritual growth, and intellectual freedoms were an essential element of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it made me realize that if I ever get to wherever he went, I might have my first shot of bourbon with Allen Ginsberg. For more on Bill Morgan and his new book, The Typewriter is Holy, The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation, go to our site, wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm David Delegater.
The boys didn't care, because on cold corners, they stood three backs to one another, facing all the winds, bent, lips don't care, miserable, cold, and broke, waiting like witch doctors, saying, "Everything belongs to me because I am poor."